Hello and welcome to TDF Talks. I'm Lucy Fagans, and this is a fortnightly podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. In this podcast, we chat to leading Australian creatives of all kinds. This is episode 37. Thank you so much for joining us. This is an enhanced podcast, which means it has pictures. If you listen using Overcast, Pocket Casts, or the latest version of the Apple Podcast app, you will see relevant images and links in your player while you listen. Today, I chat to a truly remarkable Australian artist who picked up not one, but two awards at our recent TDF Design Awards. I'm talking, of course, about Tyrone Wright, otherwise known as Roan. To be honest, it doesn't feel totally accurate to describe Roan as simply an artist or a street artist. He is such an ambitious and dynamic creative, and he really is doing so much more than just making and selling art. If you're Melbourne-based, there's a high chance you might have visited his spectacular project, Roan Empire, earlier this year. It's impossible to describe the mind-boggling scale of this self-initiated and largely self-funded project. Essentially, Roan and a team of collaborators transformed the historic Burnham Beaches property in the Dandenongs into an epic multi-sensory installation across 12 enormous rooms, bringing together Roan's haunting artwork enhanced with interior styling and decoration, botanical installations, soundscapes, bespoke scent, virtual reality, augmented reality, and more. It was a truly phenomenal feat, and over 22,000 people visited the project over a two-month period. It's the sort of project that just doesn't happen without a truly creative visionary to imagine it and to drive it, and to take a whole lot of risks to make it happen. Chatting to Roan was inspiring on so many levels. It was incredible to hear about how his career has evolved from hating high school and dropping out of uni to becoming a designer for a skateboard company and then to making a living and really building a reputation as a full-time artist. But more than that, I was so inspired by Roan's relentless creative drive. In person, he's a pretty humble guy, but one thing is clear. Roan isn't interested in doing anything the easy way. This is an artist who has found his niche, pushing creativity and collaboration right to their limits and proving that with enough passion, you really can make impossible things happen. Hello and welcome to TDF Talks. Today I'm chatting to artist Roan, who picked up not one but two awards at the Design Files Design Awards just last week. And I'm so excited to learn a little more about Roan's artwork and the incredible project that he created this year, Roan Empire. So thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Roan, you've achieved so much as an artist over the past 10 to 15 years, but I'm interested to know how you came to be an artist in the first place. So could you tell us about what you studied and what path led you to doing what you're doing now?
Yeah, for sure. I guess I started as a interest or hobby of, you know, as every kid is, you know, interested in art. But I was pretty certain that I'd never make a living as an artist, and I'd never actually met an artist who made a living. So it's something I didn't even kind of aspire to because it just wasn't within the realm of possibility for me. So since I was 15, you know, was a waiter until I was probably in my early 20s, and just like that was always going to be my fallback no matter what I did. But out of high school, failed to get into like a university design degree, which I wanted. So I went to a TAFE and did that for a couple of years, took a year off, came back and got into a university degree at RMIT as a mature age student because my high school grades were terrible. And once you're a mature age student, I found out the trick was it doesn't matter anymore.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So I was like, and then I finally got into, you know, RMIT Bachelor of Design and realized that I was kind of 2 years ahead of everyone who was there. And so I felt like I wasn't really progressing much there. And I ended up, you know, at that same time, once I moved to Melbourne and started doing the design course, I started to see a lot of other street art and stencil work on the street. This is early 2000, 2001.
Where did you move here from?
From Geelong.
Oh, Geelong. Okay, yeah.
To even say Geelong is like probably 30 minutes the other side down the Bellarine Peninsula. So it's like rural, like I grew up with you know, like horses and motorbikes. I wasn't surrounded by this
street art
environment. The street art really spoke to me, catching the train up and seeing the graffiti along the train lines and then all the stencils and stickers in the city. And I just really got hooked on that. And
what year are we talking?
This is, literally 2001.
Yeah.
And that just became something I started doing on the side of skateboarding. I was a real avid skateboarder at that time. And moving up to the city, I lost a lot of my friends from Geelong who were skateboarding. So I started hanging around with a new crowd of people who were painting more. And that became my thing to do on, you know, Friday night or the weekends. Instead of going to the pub to watch a footy, we'll go out and paint something. And it was from that that people started to see my work, and I was doing a lot of skateboard related stuff. And a skate company came to me and said, and offered me a graphic design job. And I was like, yep, cool. I quit uni. This is my dream job, you know, to work for a skateboarding company at the time.
Yeah.
And that must have been 2002. And I thought, yep, I'm done. I've got it made, you know. Doing skateboard and t-shirt graphics, that was like totally my dream at that time. Turned out, you know, 5 years later that, you know, everything gets pretty old and I was not being paid the best, and I was kind of realizing that I was missing out on other opportunities, and eventually left to go freelance and did that for maybe 5 or 6 years. And so I was a freelance graphic artist for like the fashion industry, doing like t-shirt graphics and yardage prints, repeats, like whether it's for board shorts or floral dresses.
Oh,
and
wow.
So that was my living from that. And I was always doing street art on the side.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't tell my clients about either side.
Yeah.
You know, and because I didn't want to put my artwork on t-shirts because I saw it as my day job.
Yeah.
But it's also, it kind of created this, I could distance myself from the graphic design work because you're working for a client and they want what they want and they'll come back and they'll give you changes and I don't take it personally.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, cool, whatever. But as soon as anyone was touching my artwork and they wanted to change that, it's like, yeah, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
This is mine. So I could keep the control.
Yeah.
So I actually didn't have a solo exhibition until 2011.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was kind of the point where I dropped doing any other client work and went full-time artist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And so, yeah, I'm sort of interested in the evolution there from being a street artist or graffiti artist to being able to really make a viable business out of your art. So, like, how did that happen? You were doing your freelance design work, you were painting on the side, you had your first exhibition, and then was it like straight away you could see the commercial viability of painting and selling your work?
A little bit. There was like, once I had the first solo exhibition, it sold out and I had requests for commissions, and it was like, that was enough money for me to say sorry to my clients.
Yeah.
I can't do anything for the next 6 months or something. It's like, I'm busy with artwork stuff.
Yeah.
But it probably wouldn't have worked 5 or even definitely not 10 years before that.
Yeah.
Even if my work was as good, there wasn't the following.
Yeah.
Like,
you mean you didn't personally have the following, or graffiti art, street art didn't have?
Graffiti and street art didn't have that. Like, it had an underground following. A good example is 2003, Banksy came to Sydney and Melbourne.
Yeah.
We all knew who he was within our subculture, but no one else outside of that
had heard of him.
No. And like, I know at that time he was doing album covers for bands and stuff like that. So he was kind of doing design work.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't selling $100,000
artworks
at that time. So the biggest thing you could be as a street artist, graffiti artist, is probably looking at something like Mark Echo.
Okay.
Right? Like, doing t-shirt graphics.
Yeah.
Like, that was the only kind of direction. It's like, oh, maybe I'll be able to do a t-shirt graphic one day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there wasn't that vision of like getting into galleries and museums. It was maybe some t-shirts. Like, that was it, like having a big t-shirt brand or something. So for where I am today, it's like, it just did not exist at all.
So it was sort of the right time, like, as in, like, culture was changing at the same time as you were sort of ready to step up in a way.
Yeah.
So amazing. Yeah, the graffiti scene does seem to have changed so much in the last 10 years. And I feel like, you know, there's so many opportunities now for sort of mural artists, especially at the moment. I don't know how, maybe Instagram and social media is playing into that a lot too. But Why do you think graffiti art has suddenly, or not suddenly, but over the last 10 years has got a legitimacy about it that it didn't used to have?
I think it boils down to money. It's usually the case of a lot of things. It's just like seen, you know, I think someone called it the Banksy effect.
Yeah.
Where, you know, if his work's worth $1 million, maybe something a few runs down the ladder is worth, you know, a quarter of that or something.
Yeah.
So it kind of, it helps justify a price on something. And if real money's been invested into this kind of artwork, it makes other people more confident about investing a small amount of money into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, it's a strange kind of phenomenon that nothing's worth anything until other people believe in it.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And so a lot more people are just starting to believe in it. And I think you're right saying the social media aspect probably plays into it, and people now value something they could probably stand in front of and take an image of. And there's that kind of connection with knowing the artist who had painted it and tagging them in it. And like there's that kind of network.
Yeah. So interesting. I mean, I guess culturally it's interesting to think that like this once marginalized group, like when you were a kid skateboarding and doing stencil work or sticker stuff, you probably felt like, well, it's just weird that now graffiti artists are sort of heroes and have very commercial projects. And I don't know, like, do you miss just being an artist for art's sake and sort of it being that real underground world?
Yeah. Part of what I've started doing with this installation kind of concept where, you know, I paint a wall inside an abandoned space and bring people into that comes from, I was almost getting sick of the large-scale murals and the kind of responsibility and pressure you have of
commercial reflecting, outcomes.
No, even reflecting a community.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if you're creating a landmark, it's such a big deal within a small community. It's kind of offensive if you just do something that's totally for yourself.
Yeah.
It's just this,
you ego know, thing.
Yeah, ego thing for yourself, and it has no reflection on the community. And I felt that I was getting offered more and more of those jobs, like, come and paint this person in this regional community who's important to our area, but it's kind of got nothing to do with myself.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's what should be painted there.
Yeah.
But I kind of wanted to go back to just painting in spaces where I can just paint what the hell I want, in a sense.
Yeah.
So going back into these abandoned buildings where the responsibility or the control of like who sees it was all back on myself.
Yeah.
And early 2000s, there was a series of exhibitions called empty shows where someone would find an empty abandoned building, text everyone on a Wednesday, Thursday that we knew other artists, and would all go there Thursday, Friday night and paint it illegally. And then on Saturday morning would text everyone we knew the address, and 300-400 people would show up at this abandoned building. And by, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the police would come because they'll get reports of all these people being in an abandoned building, and everyone can get to see what was painted on the walls, and it's closed down, and then it's all gone.
Wow.
Yeah. And they were really cool, exciting shows, and some amazing artists and friends I've met from doing them. And the only way those shows exist now is in the documentation. And so I just kind of plan on that idea of doing these exhibitions like that again, where it's like, it's in this one space, and the space only exists for this limited time, and the only way they live on is in the photograph or the documentation, and that becomes the work itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I'm playing on, is kind of looking back into what was more exciting for me back then.
Yeah, totally. That totally makes sense. I do want to get on to talking about Empire shortly, but first, has there been a sort of key moment for you as an artist where you feel like there's been just this real tipping point? Like, I don't know if there was ever one project or a particular commission that really had you thinking, oh, this is, I've made it, or this is really serious now, or something like that. Like, has there been a key sort of milestone?
I think about that, and like sometimes I do have things that I'm like, it was a goal and I achieved it. And sometimes I achieve those goals and I like, I'm going so fast past it that I don't have time to appreciate it.
Yeah.
I remember selling something for $100 and selling something for $1,000. Once I'd sold something for $1,000, well, I think at my first show I was selling stuff for $2,000 and I sold like 10 of them. It was just like, it just happened all so quick.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I've got a commission for $3,000 and it's just like, that milestone just got come and gone. It's like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
I can really make a living off this. So I think, and then being able to paint internationally and then paint something in these cities where I kind of aspired to go to, and even, you know, to tick off on my list of like, I want to go to Cuba and paint the walls there. It's like, all right, I've done that twice now.
Yeah.
And it's like, all right, well, that was a milestone. It's like, I've done it. And then, so it's, yeah, it just keeps happening. And then there's things I've achieved that I didn't even expect. And there's nothing to compare it to, like what we did out at Empire. It's like, I don't have another.
There's no benchmark.
Yeah, there's no benchmark to put that against to compare it. So it's a really weird thing. Like the other things I'm competing with in like some event awards and things, things like Splendor in the Grass and Vivid, you know, like the gigantic festivals. Like I'm not that level, but it's like, well, that's my other competitors into, you know, that market. It's kind of stupid. It's like where I'm not competing with other solo artists, I'm competing with like festivals.
Yeah, and big businesses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just strange.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, well, it's sort of uncategorizable, some of your latest projects like Empire. I also imagine like as your practice and your business has evolved, you must have had to learn a lot of stuff on the fly about the business side. So like, you know, client stuff and quoting and production and all that side of stuff. So what have you learned about like the business of being an artist?
I know that artists and business, you know, polar opposites. Most artists I know are terrible at business.
Yeah.
And this is where having a gallery of representation is really, really important for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I think from having those years doing freelance, learning how to manage my own money and to get paid, knowing the value of my work and how to quote something and how to bring it all together, that's taught me a lot about running myself as a business where a lot of other artists kind of struggle to see that part of it. And even down to marketing your work, as kind of crass as it seems sometimes, like painting a mural on the street is your marketing. And like I did 10 years of marketing before I had my first solo exhibition to look at it from a
point
of view like that.
Yeah.
Not that it was intentional, but it is, that's what led to me to be able to have that solo exhibition and people recognize my name before doing that.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of mindset.
Yeah.
But I don't say it's an easy thing. It's definitely, I've learnt a lot along the way by just asking a lot of people down to accountants. Accountants have kind of like made and broken me as well over the years. And I've learnt the hard way on a lot of things.
And what does your business look like day to day? Like, are you like a solo operator? Have you got sort of some admin help, or do you have assistance when you're painting something really large? How does your business work?
It's day to day. It's myself, but I have a admin assistant, Hannah, and she isn't really on site. She's just, you send an email to my website, it goes to Hannah, and she makes sure I turn up at things. Like she kind of coordinates my calendar.
Yeah.
She sends out invoices. She chases invoices. She organized a lot of logistics for printing, framing, deliveries, artworks, and other things. And she's also like a hair and makeup artist. So whenever I've done a photo shoot,
amazing.
She can kind of help with that.
Oh my God, I want my own Hannah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Hannah's amazing. And then there's people like, I share a studio with Callum Preston, and he can build anything. So I'm often working alongside him to put together dodgy kind of furniture and whatever we need to make something look good enough. But then throughout Empire, I had one or two assistants on pretty much the entire time just to help me pull that all together.
Yeah.
When Empire was open, there was like 15 staff on at any time. So
yeah,
some days I'm by myself. Some days it's like I need a manager to manage people.
And yeah.
Yeah. So I had event managers for that one. And
yeah.
Yeah. So day to day, it's quite small, just me and Hannah often.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sort of grows when it needs to. Yeah. Now, keen to talk about Rhone Empire. You guys took out two major awards, as I mentioned, at our design awards just recently. And it's safe to say that project has been your biggest project to date and just such a phenomenal achievement. I can't even begin to imagine how you pulled it off, to be honest. But can you take us back to the very start of like how that came about, like doing that project in that location?
Empire started from off the back of a project I did before that called Omega, which was in a little two-bedroom house in Alphington.
Yeah.
And it was one of the owners of the building Burnham Beaches that saw the Omega house and just said to me, I've got this place up in the hills. It's empty at the moment. Maybe I want to paint a wall or something. And
did he say this place up the hills? He didn't say it was Burnham Beaches.
He didn't specifically say it was Burnham Beaches. And even if he did say it was Burnham Beaches, which you may have.
It wasn't clear the scale of.
Yeah, it wasn't clear the scale of it. And I also didn't know, like, I'd never been there. I hadn't seen inside it.
Yeah.
So, and I didn't really know, like, people offer me a lot of things all the time, and yeah. I take a lot of it with a grain of salt, because it turns out a lot of people are like, oh, I don't really own it. I've just seen it when I drove past, when I dig on a lot of people and say, it'd be cool if you paint this. I'm like, it's in like Norway. It's like, do you know who owns it? Do you own it? It's like, no, it's just cool though. I was like, okay. So, yeah. So a lot of tire kickers sometimes. I get that. I didn't really take much of it. So I literally took about 2 or 3 months before I even went and looked at it.
Yeah.
Because I was busy cleaning up the last project, and I think the day I looked at it was, I remember looking at my phone and saying, when was the first time I took photographs of it? I think it was like late Jan or mid Feb 2018, and my baby was due. So it was me and my wife went up there, and a baby was due like Feb 28th.
So this is like 2 weeks before you're about to have your first baby.
Yeah, yeah. So we went up there and looked at it, and we're just like, wow, it's amazing. And then we kind of just said, like, can we have the whole thing? And they're like, oh, we have to talk to Heritage. I just talked to a few people, and they started doing that. And we're literally waiting for this baby, and, you know, my wife's got time off work, and they kind of come back to us like, yeah, we're really keen to basically give you access to do something there. And I think on Feb 28th, or a few days before, I got an email from, I'm signed up to this liquidation auction thing. So I know sometimes there's a whole kitchen for sale, and then there was like this reception center in West Footscray, and they're like closing down, and they had all these chandeliers. So I'm like, I want to go check this out. I reckon these chandeliers would be the perfect thing for the space. And so even going back, when we first saw the space, it was like, it was gutted. There's nothing in there. There's no starting point. It kind of made me realize, like, it would be fantastic, but we have to furnish the entire thing. Like, there's so much to fill.
But when you were standing there for that first time, did you just go, oh, my God, I just have to do this. Oh, I can't believe, like,
that's what
how annoying this is that I now have to do this giant project.
it was like a serious conversation with me and Alice, my wife. It was like, because I'd done two really big commercial projects. Like, I painted the front of a hotel in Perth, and I painted these silos down in Geelong, and they're both really well-paid jobs. And I was like, I can afford to take a year off and look after this baby and have a really nice time. Or I could blow all that money
on the project of a lifetime place
in the forest. And yeah, and so we were at this auction, and we went out there, and like, my wife's like sitting down on a chair because she couldn't stand up. It's like, all right, cool, we're gonna buy like 7 chandeliers today.
Before you'd even painted anything.
Yeah, and that's what we did. We just started, like, all right, cool. The chandeliers were so perfect for the space, and it just set a tone. It was like, all right, we're doing this. Yeah, and then we just started collecting furniture for months and months, and we didn't even have access at that point. We just started collecting stuff, and I was hanging it up at my studio, and my studio looked fabulous for a while. It's just, yeah, and then the whole time, you know, we'll text in photos to Carly. It's like, what about these? What about these? And she's like, no, no, no. We would have bought a lot more crap if it wasn't for Carly.
Yeah.
She's kind of KB'd a lot of dumb ideas that I had, so she's the one who kind of pulls me into line and makes sure it looks good.
Yeah. Just to clarify, that's Carly Spooner, who is an incredible stylist who worked with Roan on all the styling and sort of sourcing for that project. So it was like such a seriously epic production, and it does seem to me that like painting the artwork was probably your easiest job on that whole project in a way.
It was the only thing I knew I could do. That was like, all right, I can do that.
Yeah.
I've done that before. I'm confident in that.
Yeah.
I know how to paint a pretty picture.
Yeah.
That I can do.
But the production side of it, and the collaboration, and just Heritage, and I don't know, OH&S, I can't even fathom the complexity of that project.
Yeah.
So was there ever a time when you just thought you might not be able to pull it off?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We didn't have a permit to open it till, I don't know, the Friday before it opened on a Tuesday. So, yeah, there was a lot I didn't think it was ever going to open, but I had a backup plan, basically. I went into it, you know, it was a huge risk, but I'd done a project before the Amiga House one, and I never got it opened.
Really?
And most people don't even know about it because it didn't open to public.
Okay, so it was a bit more project. Underground.
Yeah, it was inside on Heidelberg Road, the old paper mill.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I painted the whole inside of all those.
Okay.
And they're all like 4 or 5 story tall murals on the inside of those before they got knocked down.
Wow.
So I painted all those,
And you couldn't get anyone in there.
I couldn't get anyone in there. And I photographed them, sold the photographs.
Yeah.
I probably got maybe 200 people in, 10 people at a time, hard hats, inductions, took 2 days. The paperwork and logistics on just getting those people in was a nightmare. But that funded the project and made it worth it in the end financially. But on a promotional level, hardly hit any media.
Yeah.
No one, such a small amount of people were able to go there and take a photograph themselves and post it.
Yeah.
So it's just like one of those unknowns. And like, that was my fallback. Like,
I knew
if I did the project, I'd have the photographs and I'd be able to do some private viewings and sell the photographs and make some money back to kind of justify spending all this money.
Yeah.
That was my worst case scenario. And I probably would have only broke even doing that. There's this weird thing. It's like opening the doors actually cost me more money.
Because of all the staffing and stuff. Yeah,
so
that's true.
I probably would have made more money if it went like that, but no one would have known about it.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like, it's a double-edged sword. It's like, but you want people to know about it. That's how kind of it's put me on another level of awareness. And like that's what's kind of more important about this than, you know, I probably could have just spent the year doing commissions and commercial work and made more money doing that.
But
no one would have really...
Yeah.
Talked about it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And so you got your permit the week before you opened. So I just want to imagine whoever was signing off your permit, like, how did that even, how was it so close? How, why wasn't, you know what I mean? Did they walk through and go, oh, okay, we probably should let people look at this? Like,
yeah, there's so many levels of bureaucracy and like there's, because it's in a high risk fire area.
Oh, yeah.
So that limited the number of people we could have inside, that was limited by the number of car parks we could have on site.
Yeah.
So the amount of car parking helped determine how many people we could have on site. The amount of car parking was limited to the access and the road
Was
there. So because of one road out off the hill, if there's a bushfire coming.
Yeah, you can't get everyone out.
Yeah.
Oh my
2 weeks before it opened, there was a fire on the site. A shed in front of the space burnt down.
Oh, my God. Okay.
So I was, like, freaking out.
Yeah. So were you, like, managing all of this stuff? Like, obviously, I know you had a team, but, like, you know, counting cars and figuring out timings.
No, I had Belinda from the Social Crew. She came on. I was talking to Visit Victoria, trying to get funding through them, and I put in a funding application. And they're like, you got no idea what you're doing. You should talk to Belinda. She does funding applications and works with us all the time. She's like a third-party events manager, and I started speaking to her, and she could speak the language of what they needed.
Yeah.
And once she came on, it's like she really kind of got all the ducks in a row, and she could deal with that world I had no idea about. So it's about finding the right people who can help you navigate that, and she really pulled that together for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the dealing with finding out, all right, what do we need for OH&S, or like getting the person out to do the fire check and –
Yeah. Wow.
And, you know, I don't know, cracking the whip so people do actually put in the car parking for us and all those little things that I shouldn't have to worry about.
Yeah. Wow. She sounds amazing. I just like want everyone's phone number who was on your team because I feel like they're all just the best at their jobs. I'm interested in the idea of temporary versus permanent in your work, which you sort of touched on before. So you create work that is sometimes commissioned, and presumably where it's commissioned, it's intended to sort of last, but your self-initiated projects are these more temporary things. And I'm just like, you know, on Instagram recently, you've been posting the process of returning Burnham Beaches back to its previous state, which is devastating because as everyone on your Instagram is saying, I can't believe that you're taking that out. I can't believe how this place looks without, you know, Empire in it. So what are your feelings about that? Like, do you feel sad to cover up all that work? I know it was a heritage requirement, but how do you feel about that process?
Yeah, it's definitely sad. Like, there's, I look at the photographs and there's a loss there. And even more so when I've gone back to the space for whatever reason, like to walk through it and it's just hollow. And, you know, it's just like, but there's also like this part of me that's kind of proud to know that we put a soul into that building for that time.
Yeah.
And it was like we really made that magic happen.
Yeah.
To create something from nothing was such a thrill. But to have it all gone, it was always going to go.
Yeah.
It was always going to go. Like whether it was this month, this year, this decade, everything gets destroyed in the end, or, you know, everything's dust to dust. And I guess what I'm doing is playing on that kind of emotion. And I lose artworks all the time painting in the street. You know, stuff gets painted over, someone draws a dick on something. It's just the way it is. That's usually my loss to bear myself.
Yeah.
But doing this, and like so many other people, have had this emotional connection to my work, and knowing that it's lost and I don't grieve it alone.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of this shared grief we all have now.
Yeah.
And it kind of like people knowing as they're witnessing the work, knowing that it's going to go and being more aware of that kind of makes the work feel more important and possibly beautiful, because it's just in that temporary state at this one time. Like if you've ever been to Japan and lucky enough to see the cherry blossoms, and you know it's only out for 2 weeks, so it's such a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah.
It'll be nice to see it if it was all year round as well, but it's like it just makes it so much more special if you were there at that perfect time.
Yeah.
To capture it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think I've just become aware of the importance of things disappearing and just kind of expanding on that idea as well, and kind of sharing that with the audience,
yeah.
I guess. Yeah, and it does all come from that street art background as well, so there's a connection there for me.
Yeah, yeah, knowing that when you make a work that you don't know if it's going to be there the next morning.
Or, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I do definitely feel that the magic is heightened when you know that you're only going to see this once and it's going to be gone next time.
Yeah, that's what kind of makes street art and graffiti exciting, and like street art kind of blogger photographer community are kind of insane, like the way they chase down things and they have to get a photo of it, because the truth is that it may be gone tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so it's very important for people to be documenting work.
Yeah.
It's a very important part of that community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're so good at that too. I mean, the documentation of Empire was next level. Like the photographs were just spectacular, and you took a lot of those incredible photographs yourself, but also the virtual reality stuff and the augmented reality. Like I just can't think of a project that's been better documented, to be honest.
It was really important to me to have it documented in every way I could, and just bringing on board the people who could do the augmented reality and the virtual reality. Like I've got no idea about it, and I don't know fully where it's going to end up in the future, but just to have it documented in that way, it's just another way to present it again in the future.
Alteja was going to end up. Yeah. It's going to end up at like some sort of NGV retrospective when you're like 70 years old, I think.
That'd be nice. Yeah, cool.
Is there anything you haven't done yet that you would love to do?
Yeah.
Now I feel like.
Do I talk about it?
I was going to say.
I want to talk about it on
the
published
record.
Format. Yes, there is.
Okay. So then.
Like a lot of people ask me like, what's next? And it's kind of. I've talked to quite a few people about it, but it's kind of working towards, you know, possibly doing other buildings and installations like this, and why can't I do this kind of project internationally? And the challenges of that, like I know I could do it, but the challenge is like, how do I finance something like that? And that's where I'm like, all right, so that's the new challenge. How do I finance a project as big as that in another country?
Yeah.
And doing the production and logistics on it is just like, well, that's 10 times harder.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of, all right, well, how do I do that?
Yeah. I'm so inspired by this side of your personality. Like I really feel every project you do is definitely like upping the ante. Like you did the Omega project. That was the 2-bedroom house in Alphington.
Alphington,
you know, then, you know, Empire is sort of the next level up from that. And everything you do seems to just grow. And I just feel like there's this part of your personality that's like, okay, let's just bite off more than we can chew and just go with it. And I don't know, the self-belief is really quite remarkable, or just the tolerance for risk, I guess, you know?
I'm willing to fail.
Yeah.
Like I take a lot of precautions, or like, you know, I take risks, but it's very calculated. Like I know, you know, if I'm going to this, like that whole thing could have failed, but I knew I could sell the photographs and make the money back and my wife won't kill me.
Yeah.
That was, you know, always had a backup plan. So if I was going to do a bigger project, it's like, right, I need to calculate all the kind of numbers on it first.
Yeah.
And kind of weigh that up. And it's like, all right, I've kind of had the belief, like I'll go into something knowing that it would be a break even or even kind of a little bit of a loss, knowing that the kind of attention and marketing that'll come back from it would be worth it. And where I really make my money is between those projects, and I'll get a big commercial project because someone's seen this. And like, you know, when a guy owns a hamburger store comes to you and says, I want to paint the side of your building, he's you might have $50, but when like people who are architects and like working in that industry, there's a real kind of budgets there, and you know, doing a couple of those jobs is better than doing 50 of those little hamburger jobs. And it's like, well, that's the kind of work I want, so I don't have to do one or two of those a year. But doing these big projects where I may or may not make any money will mean that I might be the first person they call.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. One question I've neglected to ask you, which I'm nearly at the end, but is just about your work, more specifically your painting and the style of your work. Like, how would you describe your work? Obviously, it's so distinctive and our own artwork is immediately recognizable, at least to most people in Melbourne. What's with the style? Like, how did you sort of come to this style, which is so familiar?
Like, I'm mainly known for painting like this female beauty, and that comes from putting up the stencils and posters and stickers and stuff like that. And I realized people were asking me for that on a canvas, and I'd just do that straight stencil on a canvas, and it was just this white background and black image, and it didn't have the same kind of character as on the street. And I was like, it just didn't translate. And I realized what made stuff on the street interesting was that the noise of the street, the contrast of the beauty and the decay, and as these posters were kind of rotting and falling apart, it actually made it look more interesting.
Yeah.
Like, some of the best ones I'd seen really just in that kind of final moment where they're just hanging in there, but it was like the fact that the beauty was still holding on, it just made it look so beautiful.
Yeah.
And like, it kind of, you have to take a photo of it because you know it's gone tomorrow again. And my whole work's been trying to play on that idea and like going into this whole empire thing. It's the same ethos through that. But technically painting, I started doing stencil work, and I, you know, that's sort of spray can. And I got to a point where I wanted to make my work a lot bigger. And it's just pointless cutting out a stencil that's kind of two stories tall. So I realized I had to just start painting freehand. And I was just terrible at the spray can. I was around so many other amazing spray can artists, and I'm like, all right, I don't want my work to look like theirs. I'm like, all right, I'll just do it with rollers and brush. And I worked out that you couldn't get like a nice fade like they could with a spray can. So I was just putting water with it and just spraying water and trying to blend that. And my work would kind of drip and kind of melt away. And like, it just created its own texture and style as part of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't really work on a small little canvas, but on a large wall, all those drips and stuff kind of disappear until like you have this kind of overview of it where you don't even see the drips, but up close, it's like often really drippy and messy, and it just has this thin veil to it as well. So often people ask me like, is that going to last? It looks like it's going to wash off the wall.
Yeah.
Because it's so thin.
Yeah.
And that kind of helps add to that style of like the fragility to it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just something I've kind of evolved in that way of painting to have my own style that kind of sets it apart from a lot of other artists who are using spray paint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how do you find the faces?
Since I did that first solo exhibition, I'll photograph a model or a friend or someone to paint, so I have those reference images.
Yeah.
But before that, I was just pulling things out of magazines and painting them on the street, and it was more a kind of experimentation of just putting work up.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to commercialize someone else's work.
Yeah.
Because that had happened to me in the past. Like, someone takes my work and puts it on a t-shirt, and I was like, hang on a minute, I don't really like that.
Yeah.
I get no credit for it, or they've kind of commercialized something that I didn't want to be commercialized. So I made a very kind of intended line in the sand. Like, if I'm going to be making work to sell, it's got to be 100% original.
Yeah.
Like, not sourcing from other people's work.
Yeah.
There's people who do that, source from other people's work, but it's like you usually have to have a reason for it. You know, you're making comment on
that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's not just I couldn't be bothered taking my own reference photo.
Yeah.
So interesting. So I know you can't talk about your next big project, but to close off this part of the interview.
I can talk about a project.
Okay, well, I was going to say, what's next for you, or what are you working on at the moment?
I've actually got a project at the Geelong Gallery. So that's my first institutional show.
Wow.
So that's
back to the homeland.
Yeah, definitely the homeland. And, you know, doing a show that's a bit of a survey of some of my older works, and then I'm also doing some installations alongside that.
Yeah. Wow. When does it open?
April, May 2020.
Okay. You'll have to get back to us. That sounds so cool. We'll definitely let everyone know when that happens. Well, thank you so much. And that's the end of the formal part of the interview. But now we're going to do 10 quick questions. What time do you set your alarm in the morning?
I have an 18-month child. He sets it for me.
I know that feeling.
Yeah.
What do you eat for breakfast?
Lately, I've just been eating what he doesn't eat. My favorite at the moment is sriracha on a crumpet.
Oh, interesting. What is your greatest indulgence?
Probably sriracha on a crumpet. Yeah, that's
that's the first time anyone said that.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll take it. Who is one great artist you admire?
Artists I admire. There's lots of artists doing amazing things. One who's always kind of been a inspiration for pushing Australia forward, like Anthony Lister. Like, he was going to be an artist whether street art existed or not. So knowing him in the early 2000s, like, he was always going to be an artist. Like, we would look at him and go, oh, so that's what fine art, like, should be, like, you know, going into that real world. And so he's someone who's always just, like, for me as the early days, like, he was actually, yeah, like I said, like, the only person I knew who was an artist who made a living off it.
Okay.
That's the first kind of real artist that I met.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really powerful.
Yeah.
What was the last thing you bought online? These are always the hardest questions.
Yeah, because it's kind of
something boring.
I don't buy much online. My wife buys heaps of stuff online. I'm trying to think, what did she just buy?
Usually it's like a grocery.
A dinner set. She just bought a dinner set online.
Oh, really? Yeah. Wow. Sounds cool.
Sounds risky to ship. I don't know.
That's true. What is one of your weekly rituals, something you do every week?
At the moment, it's taking Gus to the park.
Cute. What is your favourite neighbourhood in Melbourne?
Collingwood.
Yep. Me too. How do you wind down?
Probably Netflix.
It's 9 p.m. on a weeknight. What are you doing?
Probably Netflix. yeah, definitely cleaning up the kitchen, putting the TV on, making sure Gus is in bed, and yeah.
How things have changed. I feel like 10 years ago you would have been, no, maybe 20 years ago, you would have been out on the streets with a stencil and a spray can.
Yeah, maybe not on a Wednesday night.
But, okay, Friday night.
Friday night, definitely.
Yeah. And finally, if you could name just one of your proudest achievements, what would it be?
Convincing thousands of people to drive 45 minutes out of the city.
Good answer. Rowan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for this conversation. I'm feeling so inspired and I'm so grateful for your time.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
You can visit Rowan's website at www.r-o-n-e.com for more info about Rowan Empire and his other projects. You should definitely also be following him on Instagram at r_o_n_e, especially to see the mind-blowing and somewhat depressing before and after transformations that he's been sharing recently of the process of reinstating Burnham Beaches back to its original empty state. Next year, Rowan's work will be exhibited in a public institution for the first time, back in his hometown of Geelong. The Geelong Gallery will be hosting a survey of Rowan's early works along with some new installations. The show is due to open in May 2020 and we will definitely keep you posted. You've been listening to TDF Talks, a podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. Please check out our website, thedesignfiles.net, where we post new stories 3 times a day featuring Australian design, art, architecture, and more. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you've enjoyed today's episode, we would be so grateful if you would leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening.